Okay, good morning everyone. I think we should be starting right now because it's 11:20, right? And my name is David Komata. I'm a senior research officer of the Humanitarian Innovation Project, and I'm also chairing this very interesting panel, Understanding Humanitarian Innovation in Resettlement Context.
And the other side. Thank you.
Okay, and today we have four speakers in there. Gavin Akleli, and he's from you're from Asylum Seeker Research Center Innovation Hub.
Yes.
And also Face Names and Carrie Perkins, both from Southern Methodist University, and Elena Ott from Oxfam GB. And we have four presenters, but Elena needs to leave early today. So in terms of sequencing, we start with Elena's presentation, and she's going to speak about 15 minutes, and we take a Q&A just for her. Okay. And after that, we have a three presentation, Gabing and Faith and Kerry. And we take all the Q&A after three presentations are done. So that's kind of how it goes today. Without any further ado, why don't we just pass on to the floor to Elena?
Yeah, thank you now. So I'm going to focus today, I was really thinking about, I've done a lot of different pieces on refugee resettlement and kind of how this relates to innovation. And we speak a lot about bottom-up innovation. And sometimes I feel that in the continuum from choice to kind of forced, you can actually get more to kind of forced innovation, the structures as such, that we force individuals to innovate, and what are some of the implications of that. Although I am at Oxfam GB, most of the research, actually all the research I'm presenting today, was done when affiliated with the University of Oxford. So it does not represent the views in any way of Oxfam. It represents my views, and feel free to get in touch with me too if there's kind of any questions that arise when they have the broader discussion. I'm always happy to talk about refugee resettlement. So I want to begin with a few quotes. The first one's from an older Bhutanese resettled refugee, who she said, "Governments should understand the nature of refugees arriving and put us with jobs that allow life to sustain." When we talk about US refugee resettlement, it's very well known to have kind of less of a support system, particularly than other countries. And yet, in many ways, it is a success story, because individuals get jobs, they integrate in some ways into society. But many refugees wish that they were able to resettle and just get the jobs that then allowed the life to sustain, allowed them to many ways to continue their lives. Instead of, many reports have said that resettled refugees become part of the American poor and really struggle that way. And my research showed that as well. The second quote here is from a Burmese Karen refugee about some of the own innovation they do, saying, "Honestly, people from Minnesota have their own organization. They've been there for 10 years. People move there, but now the jobs have dried up. It's hard to get a job in a city. They'll drive 1 hour, 1.5 hours. Current people don't care as long as they have a job. People drive to Denison City, Iowa, 2 hours for a meatpacking job. They do a carpool. They rely on each other. So creating these networks, these different innovative networks, to survive, to have kind of social structures as well as economic structures." So briefly, I'll talk about the background around this resettlement kind of innovation definition, and then these case studies of, in some ways, innovation that's being forced by a system not meeting their needs, and in parallels with some broader humanitarian structure and how innovation can be forced there. And lastly, a few concluding thoughts. So as background, many of you may know some of these numbers. There's almost 60 million forced migrants. UNHCR definition of refugees, 14.4. 27 resettlement countries, but it's less than 1% of refugees get resettled. But still, it's considered important for the protection of vulnerable individuals. It's one of the three durable solutions by UNHCR, and has normative and kind of political importance as an expression of solidarity. As far as US refugee resettlement goes, where the research will focus today, over 3 million refugees have been resettled since 1975. The program costs over $1 billion per year, and the central tenet is economic self-sufficiency, employment. You look at the 1980 Refugee Act, that's central despite the fact that resettlement is thought of as primarily humanitarian, not economic program. So these are kind of just the numbers of U.S. refugee resettlement. My three case studies focus on the three groups that have been kind of most prominent in some of the recent years. You see the initial dip after 2011, but it's about fairly steady around 70,000 per year. I've looked at resettlement over the decades. So like there's 1.25 million Southeast Asian refugees. So particularly if you look at refugee resettlement more in the 80s, and you have different waves. So you have Afghan, you have Somalis. I think the Somali, and particularly Somali Bantus, did arrive around 2004, 2005. But you have a lot of mix of groups, different Eastern European groups that have been prominent kind of over time. And sometimes who gets resettled is obviously somewhat of a political decision. And people often talk then, Bhutanese have been resettled. It's interesting because there's not much political kind of connection there with the U.S., but they're considered in some ways more apolitical and easier refugees, call them. So to get to like to innovation and resettled refugees, so I take the definition, kind of the best definition, the one OCHA does, of the process of the adaptation and improvement. So thinking then about, well, how do refugees, resettled refugees, interact with innovation? And they interact in a lot of different ways. One of the main things I do think they do when they're resettled is they move. They move locations, they move states, they move within a city. They use their networks. We talk about employment. They find and improve their employment prospects. Five ways to do that, including creating small businesses. Refugees are often cited as having higher entrepreneurial rates than other populations. They find social support and generate kind of formal support networks and have different ways of information sharing that I've seen among a lot of resettlement populations. So I'm going to talk mainly about kind of that migration after you're resettled within a country, which is called secondary migration, and that as kind of an innovation in itself. So the first case study is kind of Burmese refugees to meat packing towns, which is interesting because less than 2% of refugees originally arrive in non-metropolitan areas. But then you have these small towns that refugees are moving to and often moving to quickly to have semi-well-paying, steady jobs. So in Dumas, Texas, there's only 20,000 in the whole county, but there's been 900 from Burma using housing primarily in FEMA trailers because the Federal Emergency Management Association, because it had been affected by tornadoes in that area. Garden City, Kansas, you have about 1,200 refugees with a population of 27,000. For the Burmese, you see a lot of kind of chain migration for these meatpacking towns. So maybe men go first, and then other populations follow. And these meatpacking towns sometimes had waves of different immigrants. And as the crackdown on illegal immigrants happens, then refugees find them. So you also see that, as the beginning quote showed, that they'll have even jobs in driving people to meatpacking towns. So helping people kind of migrate and move. And so some entrepreneurship in there. And in spreading the word about the jobs as well. My second kind of look was at Iraqis in Detroit. So this is a very different looking kind of location. So it lost 25% of its population between 2000 and 2010, known as very economically depressed city and area. And yet Iraqis are moving there. Federal funding accounted for them to receive 845 refugees per year. And then they received 3,000. The state refugee coordinator talked about how just the numbers that he knew about, they had, in 2 years, they went from knowing about 150 who moved from another state to 450. And the Detroit area resettlement agencies at one point said, no, we can't take it anymore. We don't have, there's no jobs here. And then they found that the refugees were just moving there on their own. And so they said, well, if they're going to go ahead and move there, we will try to take some and help them integrate better. So the structure of the resettlement system is kind of designed as if refugees arrive in one place and then they don't move. So the funding is most of the funding they receive is within the first year. There's some services within the first bond, but very kind of minimal. And the idea is to get a job within 3 to 6 months. And the funding is then supposed to follow if someone immediately moves or farther down the line moves to another location. But in reality, it doesn't. So by refugees moving, they're showing their own agency and kind of going against the structural system of resettlement, and against many times the wishes of those resettlement agencies. And in Detroit, they can seem to kind of be opening up shops to be revitalizing neighborhoods in many ways, and they've worked kind of an integration plan in encouraging or in incorporating refugees and other immigrants. And then Bhutanese refugees, and specifically in Pittsburgh is where most of my research is focused. And you can see overall, the state that received the highest number of first arrivals was indeed Pennsylvania, where there's Pittsburgh. And then I was able to, so one interesting thing about this movement is we have kind of no way of tracking how refugees are doing after they arrived. The secondary migration is really not covered. But I was able, because they're so well organized in Pittsburgh, through the Bhutanese Community Association, that they had done a kind of census sample and then consulted with the communities to make sure they weren't leaving out everyone. And so I was able to get a representative sample of Bhutanese refugees in Pittsburgh, which is very rare to kind of have that data. So this shows the density concentrations of the neighborhoods they lived in. Many of them have new resettlement agencies didn't help them sit on these neighborhoods that they decided they'd want to. So there's a lot of kind of even agency in it and where they locate within the city. They've also had the request to be settled there. They say in Nepal, Pittsburgh is very famous. So there's a lot of agency and people realizing that that's where they have there's jobs and where it's more affordable. One man in Colorado who was resettled to Colorado, and he spent 6 months looking for a job. He had 10 interviews. He had absolutely perfect English, and he couldn't get a job. So he borrowed money from a friend, found out through networks that there were jobs in Pittsburgh, and he moved to Pittsburgh. And he was very thankful for the job he was then, again, able to be found through networks completely outside of kind of the settlement structure. But that was in a kind of almost Amazon-like conditions. So he was monitored every second, and he was supposed to go retrieve goods and bring them. And so every second he was on the clock working 10-hour shifts. Very difficult type of work. Some of the families that I interviewed and did the survey with had been resettled in Alaska. And then moved to Pittsburgh. Alaska was not kind of the bright climate that they wanted to be in. There was very kind of innovative organizing, just completely within the Bhutanese community. So they decided that after a death, they would pool together money so that people could have obtained their death rituals. And they do this both for they had different amounts that people were supposed to give if the death was locally or if the death was overseas. And they created, online different phone networks to say when there is employment and to communicate about kind of housing and other opportunities as well as cultural events. But there was very kind of unmet desires in terms of education and steady employment. And I think maybe some of the later presenters will talk about this more in regards to resettlement. And the Bhutanese population was really prioritizing education, so wherever they could send someone to school, they were doing that. But a lot of individuals with master's degrees could only get very basic level jobs. People who hadn't finished certain degrees weren't able to do so. But they were doing everything they could to even send 20-year-olds to high school to get that kind of diploma and to try to get a better life. But by and large, what my data showed was the Bhutanese population was employed but with very strong, heavy mobility concerns. And they would get employment fairly quickly after arrival, most here within the first 10 weeks after arrival. These, some of these later ones are people who've been later turned 18 or who arrived in a different location and are secondary migrants. But the average wage was $9.51, which is not much in the US and much lower than the Pittsburgh average. And the median wage, because that number was driven by a few individuals who were doing a bit better, quite a lot better, was $9 an hour. So there was low cash assistance usage, let's cut off, but very high food assistance other usage. So the government support, again, really wasn't there for refugee resettlement. So very low of kind of any cash. TANF, this is the US welfare, but this is the US SNAP, that's the US food assistance. So over 70% of households were receiving kind of food assistance. This is for women, infants, and children. A lot were going to kind of independent agencies and food pantry, social security assistance, and then the sort of health insurance and heating assistance. They were part of the American poor and facing a lot of the same issues there as being part of the American poor. And part of that is insecurity for the ability to pay the bills. So 42% always had enough money. A lot of people sometimes had trouble. But interestingly, nobody reported that they always had trouble paying the bills. But people talked about borrowing from family and using a lot of different informal networks. So I want to make sure to do some parallels with kind of other humanitarian situations and how innovation might actually not be what we're looking for, because we might be having a structure that in some ways forces it against what actually individuals want, which in this case a lot of them talked about wanting a steady, well-paying job, wanting to get education force and then do that. So we see in kind of a lot of broader humanitarian situations, refugees moving to urban areas and moving underground sometimes, you know, getting rid of that refugee label for their own well-being and employment. See bottom-up necessity out of necessity and poverty. And so poor economics, SG Flow, and others have talked more about this. But saying that people don't want to be entrepreneurs, they want more kind of a well-paid government job. If you ask adults, what do they want for their children? And because the poor have so little, we often see them weighing the importance of their choices more than others would. In order to survive, they have become outstanding economists. I think you could also say in some ways they've become outstanding innovators in some times, although it's not actually what they might most desire. So just really briefly to conclude, I think there's a demonstrated need and desire to improve the situation amongst resettled refugees, particularly kind of their economic self-sufficiency. But you also see the community moving and finding its own solutions and many to succeeding. And I think it's important to maintain that kind of first quote that I opened up with, of what should the purpose of resettlement be? Well, as one Bhutanese said, it should be allowing the life to sustain. And maybe the structures are doing that, and we need to rethink the structure rather than forcing people to find ways outside the structure to try to allow their life to sustain better. So thank you very much, particularly to all the different funders that helped fund different aspects of the research and collaborators. Are there any questions?
Thank you very much. And so after that, what do we do, Gavin?
So if I get everyone on, Gavin Appley, I'm from the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre in Australia. I'm not an academic, I'm a layman, so I've worked in employment programs for asylum seeker for almost a decade. It's high volume work, so you know, our clients are in the thousands. And we're part of a large organisation, the largest in Australia, that has around 30 different programs, so everything from food, to employment, counselling, a health clinic, it's all under the one roof, right up to activism and advocacy. We don't take any federal government funding, so that we can remain autonomous and seek help. So these are from my experience working all these years in employment, and I've just finishing a Churchill Fellowship. I've been travelling around the world and had a great opportunity to meet amazing practitioners, best practice around this stuff. So I'm sort of going to give you a bit about where my thoughts are heading now around what we're talking about now is ecosystems. So I'll just give you some information about the situation. So Department of Immigration did a longitudinal study on refugees settling in Australia. 80% will not participate in the workforce after 2 years, and it goes down to around 70%. I was really, this was a few years ago, really struck by this because when they released it, they had all these other different visa categories, and refugees fared the worst. Like, it was double what everyone else was experiencing. So I rang up the professor who did the study, and I said, "What's going on here? How can this be? How can these outcomes be so bad?" And she said, "Well, if you look at all the other visa categories, there's family reunion, business, all those people come with contacts. The refugee always comes in isolation, they don't come with anyone." 33% of refugees, so it's a bad situation for the youth as well. 80% of jobs aren't advertised, as we know. 30% of asylum seekers have professional qualification, and every client has access to a smartphone and computer. So some years back, my wife, we had a child, and it was a very, very hard time for my wife, and like a lot of women now, because of the breakdown of community, she was very isolated, and she was always against Facebook and all this kind of stuff. She got onto Facebook, and I watched her her support group grow very rapidly. And they were doing things like exchanging babysitting and just and support. And I thought, you know, why can't we do this for refugees? You know, this is the big issue is they don't have connections. Basically, it's who you know in Australia, like it is in most places in the world. So we started having this idea of Facebook. The problem was that refugees, and when I'm talking about refugees, I'm talking about asylum seekers. When they're going through their legal case, if someone who's a Tamil Tiger friends them on Facebook, it can actually affect their case because the person assessing and going, "Well, hang on, how come this person's your friend? You're saying that you had nothing to do with these people." So when we're speaking to the asylum seekers, we're saying, okay, we need to build some kind of a networking platform. They were saying it can't be Facebook. So we came to the conclusion we need to build a standalone social networking platform for asylum seekers. Now, just before I go to that platform, on this Churchill Fellowship, we're talking about the ecosystems, and it's the catchword now. You've got to build a good ecosystem for people, and to have a good ecosystem, it really allows them to thrive. When I started really breaking down what is an ecosystem when we're talking about, what I'm finding from these interviews is there's kind of six key elements. There's the physical world that people live in, so they've got to have shelter. So we need, you know, this ecosystem, we've got to think about those physical needs. The social emotional one, I was over in Kosovo in the Innovation Lab, and they were sort of worrying about a whole lot of other things around innovation and employment. But they're finding that this is actually probably one of the most important parts of an ecosystem, that a person has an emotional support, has social feelings that that anything's possible, self-esteem and all that kind of stuff. Communication, obviously. The laws and the culture, so just this thing of understanding how Australia works or how you know the workplace works in Australia. And then there's this resources web, and this is the really interesting thing I think now when we talk about ecosystems. If you look at natural ecosystems, there's this thing called food web. And it's basically where you are in the food web is your ability to provide or to receive, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And then there's relating ecosystems. So they found, like, if you, you know, if you start getting women to do entrepreneurial work or start trying to raise their positions. They found that domestic violence starts going up because it's changing these other relating ecosystems that are occurring. So we can't do anything in isolation. So we have to make sure that whatever we're trying to do in innovating to improve the outcomes of refugees, that we're taking these six elements, I guess, of the ecosystem into account. So I'll just get to the resources web. So we're talking about a food web, and I've just drawn this, it's not anything, but basically when we're talking about all these interconnections between people, and that's what we're calling about a food web or a resources web. And basically, if you really think about our position, particularly in Australia, white and male, it's these connections that you have that determine your success. You know, people don't go to private schools in Australia or to get a good education. They go there because of the people they meet at those private schools. You do an MBA at Melbourne Business. It's not the actual study that you're doing. It's actually you're rubbing shoulders with very powerful people who are going to make your life a lot easier. Now, the thing is this, in the resource of purpose is niche. And I think when I do these models, why I'm doing it is because we need to understand what we're doing. It's okay to kind of say we need to get people jobs, but we have to understand what is the structure that is blocking these people from reaching their potential. Now, a niche for refugees is very isolated. For the next slide. And the reason is, I believe, is they're seen as recipients and not as providers, and that's why they're isolated from these really high yield nodes where, you know, that could be big businesses or these, you know, lucrative jobs, or they lack access to a supportive ecosystem. And the biggest problem, which is my topic of my next talk, is they become reliant on the agency. And the agency sits between the refugee and the high-yield nodes within the network. The agencies, which I won't go into too much now, are actually part of the problem because we're an artificial thing that implants itself within this food web, resources web, and we create a fake, a false dynamic where people become reliant on us to actually to improve their lives. So what we really should be doing is this. Instead of them coming to us and then us helping them connect with people, this is ideal, is that we're interconnecting them into the high yield nodes. And the reason is the most effective assistance that you can give for anyone is if someone from the community helps someone else from the community. It's highly efficient, and that's why refugees use remittances. That's why people do crowdsourcing now. They don't want to go through an agency because they know that the agency is going to lose a lot of the benefit through bureaucracy. What we need to do is actually take ourselves out of being a bottleneck and allow people to connect without our intervention. So we built this web platform with the help of an amazing designers who did a lot of it for free. I think in the end it cost us 20 grand, but it's probably worth a couple of hundred. So basically it's like a LinkedIn. It's basically like a LinkedIn for refugees. So someone's just scrolling through it here. Now what we had was, there's a heap of people in Australia who want to help refugees. We have people coming in all the time, CEOs, bosses, people from these high yield parts. They just don't have the time. They don't have the time. They're all working full time, but they want to participate. So through this online platform, those people can participate anywhere in Australia or in the world, really. And for the refugees, because most of them have no money, it allows them to be able to go online, people check their resumes, they help them understand the industry, they match really well, so it's not just an IT with an IT, it'll be like someone who's specifically in an area of networking connects with someone specifically in the area of networking. Now the great thing about this is trying to help refugees find professional work is the toughest. I can find somebody, farmer, I can find a job tomorrow, no problem. Finding somebody who is a doctor or a geologist is so much later, it's labour intensive. But the great thing is we don't have to do it. Again, if we remain the bottleneck, we're overwhelmed, we don't have to do it. There are people in the community who want to do it, we just need to make it easier for them. I'll just give you a quote there. Yeah, obviously the top part of that person, he went on to become an accountant and through this program, and he's got a very well-paid job now. Yeah, it's actually them helping them understand the Australian perspective. If I say to an accountant, you know, it's very hard to get a job in Australia, it's just basically a worker telling an accountant that. But if another accountant who understands this person's background says it and says it's going to take you some time, it's a lot easier for the refugee to understand that this is going to be a long-term process. That's the mayor of Footscray, for instance. So he's on part of the program. We have, again, CEOs, heads of companies, heads of organisation being part of it. We also have a social entrepreneurs program, so that we're linking now the Works website into our social entrepreneurs program. So that's setting up, connecting people who want to go down the entrepreneur path with other entrepreneurs and community support. Again, I'll just get back to this end. Other than the physical part, the mentoring website really tackles at least five of those six elements. And from now on, as I progress and look at solutions, I'll continue now to really look at those elements and anything that we bring in or design will now all have to take in those things into consideration. And I'll just, the last thing, so that's, these people are amazing, they're doing a fantastic job on those programs. The important part of it is every 3 months they have a get together, so they do see each other face to face, and if the program runs for a year and if they want to continue after that, we kind of allow them, but we say that it's a year program. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Kevin.
No worries.
So, should we start with the next? So next presentation is by Basecamp and the innovative strategy how refugees have carried a lot of things.
Thank you, now. I recently went to see the Broadway musical Titanic, and there's this wonderful scene in it where the third class steerage passengers stand up and one says, "When I get to America, I want to be a nurse's maid." And another one sings, "I'm going to be a seamstress." Another one, "An actress, an engineer." And then someone belts out, "A millionaire." Right? So are the dreams and stories of many refugees on their plane rides to America. We have talked to many and hear their stories about what they thought they would do in America, or the kinds of jobs that they envisioned that they would get, the kinds of skills that they brought with them, and how they thought those would translate. Unfortunately, with the language barriers and their unfamiliarity with the U.S. markets and regulatory systems, non-transferable credentials, and a lack of recognition of the kinds of skills that they're bringing into the country, that leaves those hopes and dreams for the refugees, unfortunately, on the plains before they arrive. Over the past 2 years, our forced migration program at Southern Methodist University has worked at understanding the existing barriers for refugees to career ladder into living wages. We consider living wages $5 above the minimum wage currently that sits at $7.25 as minimum wage, but living wages is approximately $5 more than that. And we looked at capturing the strategies that refugees who have been in the U.S. for 30 years or more have used. We don't keep records of refugees of what happens to them after they leave the system, so to say, of support after a few years. And so we were interested in talking with people on how they have career laddered, how they've moved beyond these barriers. And we're looking to build models to facilitate their ascension into the middle class using a combination of existing structures and their own strategies. In this presentation, I'd like to highlight for you what some of those challenges are, some of their solutions, and some realities, and challenge you to think about how you might be able to facilitate those in whatever position you find yourself. When we think about the livelihood prospect of potential refugees, of refugees who come to America, they usually fall into three groups. And the first that we've heard talk about is the highly skilled. Those are people who are coming with college degrees, master's degrees, and higher. Then we have the not highly educated, but from an urban area where they were exposed to education, exposed to the idea that education is a way up, and also been exposed to a wide range of career possibilities. Even if they couldn't obtain those, they saw a lot of different livelihoods. And then third, those who are coming from extreme rural backgrounds, who had very limited exposure to education, technology, and different livelihood tracks or opportunities. For instance, I was a farmer. I only know of people who are farmers or people who work in markets. Each of the three groups poses a unique set of challenges for earning a living wage in America. For the highly skilled, for the same reasons that you were just talking about, their credentials don't transfer, and recredentialing has an enormous cost attached to it and time, not to mention language difficulties. And most are left accepting jobs outside of their skill set. One of the questions that was posed earlier to our first presenter was about programs that might limit that. And when you come to America, you can get an extra month or two of financial support if you accept a matching grant program. And the matching grant program has you sign a contract that says that you'll take whatever job is offered to you. And most people sign it. I think 90% of the people in Texas just sign that they're going to do that. But the types of jobs that are offered to them are whatever jobs come in. At one particular agency, there's two huge whiteboards, and one lists all the people who have come into America in the order that they have come to that agency, and the other side lists all the exploitive minimum wage jobs that people are calling, asking for refugees for. And they're literally matching the top name to the top job. So no matter what your skills or language proficiency at this particular agency, you get the Walmart job because that's next, or you're going to get the job at bagging groceries or pushing shopping carts because that's what's next, and your contract says that you need to accept that. So once they enter into those jobs, they now can't afford to go back to school or to get the licensing or recredentialing that they need to work in the field that they came from. Those that have come who have had some education you are often coming without recognized high school diplomas, or they've left without those credentials. They've had schooling, but they don't have those credentials with them. But they have language and also language issues. This group understands the value of education in getting a job and moving ahead. However, their limitations are childcare. Their limitations are time for school. If I'm working full-time at Walmart in the job that they gave me, I can't also do my domestic responsibilities and go to school or even attend ESL classes, and they're often left outside. Many of these people that are coming with skills also mentioned that we don't have the technology to use those skills in the U.S. For instance, one person said, I helped build homes and did construction, but not with the kind of power tools that we're using in America. So they don't quite have that skill gap. Or I was in sales, but I've never used a cash register, right? Or they don't have the computer skills. So they are lacking in, or even we were farmers, but they don't know how to use the mechanized equipment that might be used in farming in America. So there is skills, but maybe a gap in how those might be used. And that goes back to the comment of our first presenter who said that without people say, well, if you haven't done it in America yet, you don't have American work experience, what they're really meaning is you might have done that in some form before, but we don't think you know how to do it in our market with our type of technology and equipment. The third group that has little or no education often are don't have literacy even in their own language. They don't have a GED or a high school equivalency. There is probably no probability of them getting that because they don't have the, you can't start from first grade again once you come as an adult and get the those credentials. And in America, more and more jobs are, you're eliminated from those jobs if you do, or even vocational programs unless you can produce a high school equivalency. And so they are eliminated by and large from those professions. There are stuck into minimum wage jobs that have little advancement opportunity. Something we found that was different from the first presenter is we found a lot of people who wanted to be entrepreneurs. A lot of people wanted to do things but had very little knowledge of the regulatory system. Matter of fact, with Congolese in general, most Congolese came with small business experience. However, less than 1% are practicing small business in the United States. They don't know how, don't have the capital to start a business. They don't know how to start a business. The regulatory system is much more challenging. They can't just open a blanket and sell something. So even though they wanted to do it, they had no idea how to do it. As a result, we found that those who were highly skilled were most likely to experience downward mobility, that they would have a very hard time ever recapturing the status that they had before they left. Those whose professional credentials didn't transfer, who resettled way back into the 1980s, came at a time when there was a more generous three-year aid package for incoming refugees. Those kind of strategies that those people used back then was taking a year or so to learn the language, and then getting into a vocational program where they knew that they could make living wages. A lot of them went back to do things that were related to the highly skilled job they had, but not the exact thing. For instance, a physician assistant became a nurse, which was still highly paid in America, or a pilot became an aircraft mechanic. So they were able to get involved at least in the skill track that they came from. However, by using vocational schooling, which was maybe 2 years as opposed to maybe in 8 years or something. Today they're using strategies such as Upwardly Global that serves the as a professional bridge for skilled refugees. They can contact Upwardly Global, who now offers their services through the internet through all of the U.S., where they people who come with a college degree can take some mid-term bridge courses that help prepare you for a job in America. They also serve as a headhunter agency for highly skilled refugees. So they're placing engineers in the engineering field. They're placing former doctors into the medical field, perhaps not as a doctor, but in that field as well. So we have found a lot of highly skilled refugees are using things like Upwardly Global as a strategy. Others are taking work as translators or something within the field that they worked in while they work on their licensing and credentials. Many others are finding that too time or cost prohibitive, for instance, $19,000 to, you know, transfer like a plumbing license or something. And while trying to support a family, they just aren't able to do it. One respondent talked about the shock and disbelief that they wouldn't be able to continue their career as an engineer or a doctor. They said that depression followed as they got jobs in Walmart. And there's just stacks of people who come in with professional degrees that are working minimum wage jobs and without that bridge to get there. This has also led to some negative strategies of supplementing their wages. There is a particular ethnic group in the U.S. who is coaching each other on how to qualify for Social Security claiming a mental disability. I sat with a group that was coaching each other. You need to say you have dreams. You need to say that you have this, and you need to say you have that. Then they're getting on Social Security and using the Social Security and then working under the table for cash at other businesses within their ethnic group. And that was their way of career laddering. When I talked to one about that, he said, we'd rather be crazy than poor. For these reasons, this group was most likely to experience downward mobility in resettlement. Those that we found that came from rural backgrounds were most likely to use their traditional or cultural strategies as safeguards against the low stability of the low wage, the instability of the low wage market. We have found things like Ethiopians practicing in the IKU, which is a rotating savings and credit association. Laotians pooled their money. Cambodians, who had the highest poverty rate in America, worked informal jobs on the side. Hmong sought to raise, sought land. They raised their own meat and poultry and sausage and hunting. And some also did short-term training jobs that don't require language or schooling, such as truck driving. What is interesting is that the amount of people who supplemented their income on survival skills they learned in asylum. For instance, there's a lot of people, Iraqis, who are coming doing opening car shops, and they said, we learned to fix cars in asylum. People who learned to do construction, security guard, teaching, or even some entrepreneur skills that they learned in asylum. And it's interesting because it supports the argument that asylum countries are leaving cash on the table by taking by these people who have learned these skills and then are using them to profit economy in their third countries of resettlement. Certainly that could be an argument for asylum countries letting them do that there. What we're looking at is we ask refugees how they would redesign the system. What is it that if you could do it again, what would help you? And across the board, they said, we want to learn skills. We want to learn the vocations that pay a living wage. One person described it as we're driving on a highway in the slow lane, and all these other cars are moving past us quickly, and we don't know how to get from here to that lane. They don't have that bridge. They don't know how to do it. And that we advocate for ESL to skill programs that combine both learning a language and learning a vocation simultaneously, and that those programs take place during the first 4 to 6 months of arrival in the U.S. when they're already on support, which that doesn't happen right now. Those programs are available to refugees now. They serve the under and unemployed in America. However, they can't get into them because of the language. There are two programs that we looked at. One offered ESL on the side and then a vocational training in the evening, and that was an utter failure because the ESL was not connected to the vocational training, and they would go at night and they couldn't understand the textbooks and they couldn't understand what they were doing. An opposite one was combine the two together. The language they were learning was actually the language of the job. They were learning the job and learning the language, and that one has been successful. Coincidentally, that successful one was designed and is run by refugees, and the first program that isn't was top-down designed by well-meaning Westerners. And so the good news is that America has just recently passed a Workforce Development Act that pumps a lot of money into vocational training for under and unemployed people, and there's a literacy component that is mandated to go along with it. What is happening, though, is that we don't have ESL to vocation programs. So people are stuck either taking the ESL and then years later getting vocational training because there aren't these combined jobs. So in closing, I would say that what we're advocating for is that we fund the top 25 paying jobs that have the largest need for employers in the area, construction, pet grooming, wind turbine working, things like that, right, that pay living wages and that have six-week vocational programs to get certified for it. And what we're doing is looking at the companies who would most likely benefit from the graduates of those programs and asking them to invest in the creation of an ESL to whatever program. And then the federal funding can be used to actually teach those programs. For instance, there's a shortage of pet groomers in America. Should people like Petco and PetSmart, which are these large big box companies in the U.S. that hire and need those people, should they invest a one-time $10,000 into creating an ESL to pet grooming program, then the vocational schools could get that federal grant money to teach those programs, and refugees could come in and take them, get skilled, and move into living wages early on. So our next phase is taking those 25 programs that we've identified, finding the private sector partners who could fund those the creation of the ESL program, and then using the federal grant money to have these vocations taught to refugees. And what that is a program that's a career laddering strategy that's actually designed by the refugees for the refugees. It's bottom-up innovation at its best. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Grace. And now we move on to Gary. And the title is The Road to Resettlement, Transition from the Thai-Burma Border to Dallas, Texas.
Yeah. Hello, everybody. All right. So to start, my name is Carrie Perkins, and I'm a cultural anthropologist. I'm also based at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. I've just come back from the Thai-Burma border, and so I'm very keen to talk to everybody today about some of the research that I'm working on. To start with, Thailand's largest refugee camp, My Law, is a dense, overcrowded community of over 45,000 people located on the country's border with Burma. This camp was originally established in 1984. Bamboo huts comprise the sprawl of all the dwellings, with most of the residents owning just a few possessions beyond NGO-issued goods and a few personal belongings. Most refugees in My Law subsist on a ration of rice and fish paste, but with declining concern from international donors over the civil war in Myanmar, the food rations in the camps have recently been cut, causing serious concern. Within the camp, there are schools, small shops, and a health clinic, and however, there's one hut that doesn't quite fit in. While it may look similar from the outside, inside it resembles a small modern apartment with appliances, an oven, a bathroom, and a fridge full of fruits and vegetables and eggs. But all of that food is plastic, and the appliances don't work, and no one actually lives in that hut. And it's a simulator apartment that's been set up by the IRC, otherwise known as the International Rescue Committee, one of the largest resettlement agencies in the U.S., designed to get the My Law refugees accustomed to different modern-day amenities before they finally immigrate to any of the dozens of countries that take people in that are fleeing Myanmar, including the U.S., also Australia, Denmark, Canada. In this picture, you can see the refugee modeling, the fake food there. But so in the following presentation, what I want to do is by using qualitative interviews from refugees both preparing for resettlement and those who have already made the transition to the U.S., I hope to bring voice to the many different challenges and struggles and the successes that are encountered along the way to the road to resettlement. The research procedure that I've used includes 25 semi-structured qualitative interviews with refugees from two different ethnic groups, the Karen and the Shan, living within either My Law refugee camp or the bordering town of Mysat, followed by three interviews with NGOs that were implementing livelihood and cultural training programs, and as well as an analysis of the relevant literature and then contextualizing that situation in the broader international legal framework of the human rights of refugees. Additionally, findings from 75 qualitative interviews from Burmese refugees living in Dallas, Texas, were considered in the findings of this paper that I will present. So, to start, just a very brief overview of the Thailand-Burma border. Myanmar is currently the fifth largest refugee-producing country in the world, according to the UNHCR report on global trends. The country has expelled more than 415,000 people through state-sanctioned violence, human rights abuses against civilians as a strategy of war, and an ongoing civil war waged against the different ethnic groups in areas outside the capital of Yangon. At the time of independence in 1948, ethnic groups were unable to achieve self-rule, and ethnic armed forces rebelled against the Burmese government's attempt to exploit their land and control them through what has been referred to as Burmanization, or the control and domination of ethnic groups by the dominant Burman tribe. Human rights abuses against ethnic civilians, such as forced labor, rape, pillage, land grabbing, and exploitation, were first reported in the ethnic areas in the 1970s and 80s, after which more than 150,000 people fled to Thailand seeking refuge in these camps. The refugees have now been there for over 30 years. The seemingly intractable nature of Myanmar's ethnic conflicts has meant that for many years, resettlement to a third country has been the most appropriate, durable solution to the plight of many refugees on the border. So within the My Law refugee camp, the International Rescue Committee, among several other NGOs, has really been instrumental in preparing refugees for resettlement to the U.S. However, the standard amount of time that's given for cultural training from the IRC is generally a maximum of just 5 days. And so within this time, they learn about employment, finding a job, the education system, U.S. laws, transportation, international travel, as well as a small mock-up training Western-style apartment that we saw in one of those those earlier slides. And if you really think about how much you can learn in 5 days or in a 5-day course, I mean, that's really just not enough time for anybody to grasp those in any sort of meaningful way. So some international NGOs and local community-based organizations, such as the TBC, which stands for the Thai Border Consortium, they provide refugees with opportunities for skills training and income generation, although these projects really only reach a very small part of the refugee populations. As I mentioned, there's 45,000 refugees in Mylaw alone, and only a small percentage of those will actually get an opportunity to do these skills trainings. And as mirrored in several interviews that I've had with both refugees and NGO workers, refugees are often left extremely frustrated after taking place in these trainings because now they have nowhere to use these newfound skills. Sometimes they have taken part in skills training after skills training, but then there's nowhere to apply it. Or they'll learn how to do a weaving course, but then there's no money to buy the materials to do that. So you have the training and there's absolutely no practical application, which just leads to a continual cycle of frustration. However, there is good news. The TBC does have several successful projects in the camps, such as the Community Agriculture Program, called CAP, that's currently implemented in 8 of the camps along the border. CAP gardening activities are important in that they increase not only the availability of fresh food in camps, which is extremely important, and they prepare refugees with vital livelihood skills. As a result of CAP activities, hundreds of households in the camps are now able to cultivate their own gardens. Which is exciting, of course. Other organizations also undertake training activities in the camp. COERR, which you might be familiar with, stands for Catholic Office for Emergency Relief and Refugees. For example, they've done training for refugees on appropriate and sustainable organic agricultural practices, assisted refugee communities to develop basic social work technical skills, and provided vocational training for individuals in extremely vulnerable situations. The range of vocational trainings and agricultural initiatives that are available to the people, it really expands their preparation for a vast array of livelihood strategies potentially useful in the resettlement context. Some of these interventions include, like I mentioned, organic farming, cooking, hairdressing, motorcycle repair, income generation through pig raising or microcredit for small shops, additionally soap making, handicraft making. But however, in the most recently conducted NGO survey on employment, more than 50% of refugees in the 7 camps listed their current occupation as housework, and more than 55% reported having no income at all. So while the main challenge for vocational trainings has been the inability to match trainings with real job opportunities or practical application, the recent adoption of the Thai accreditation for 10 of ADRAs, which is the Adventist Development for Relief Agency, their vocational trainings will actually increase the future employability of graduates and create sustainable benefits for participation in the event of a durable solution, such as resettlement. This 3-year project provided occupational skills training for approximately 6,000 refugees, so while still a small number comparatively speaking, 6,000 is no small feat. They provided this training in the areas of barbering, beauty salon and hairdressing, small engine mechanics, sewing, tailoring, child and elderly care, cooking and baking, and courses for some high school students. The certification really does have significant weight for the future, but given the current policy of containment that's going on the Thai-Burma border as a result of the coup that happened in May of last year, it's carrying no current bearing on employability because refugees are really not allowed out of the camp, even on a day pass now, to look for employment in Thailand. But overall, the range of vocational skills training that are available builds on the ideas of human capital of refugees by diversifying their skill sets in ways that might be particularly meaningful in the context of where they have the economic freedom to participate in a wider economy. So like one of your questions mentioned, do refugees have the ability to look for any job when they resettle? And the answer is yes, the options are available. Whether they're able to get there is of course a more complex problem. But targeted vocational trainings based on market assessments of resettlement countries would have greater benefits. The relatively small percentage of refugees participating in the livelihoods programs is also a drawback, as some people are not even fully aware of the ongoing projects that are going on or the benefits that it could bring to them or their households, or if they were to resettle. So these livelihood activities were successfully implemented within the camp prior to resettlement are essential for refugees to regain things such as confidence, motivation, as well as a sense of independence from external aid. Since 2005, the UNHCR and CDS-DPT have advocated with the Thai authorities for a relaxation in the policy of confinement to camps. The policy nevertheless remains in place and restrictions have recently been tightened. While many refugees make significant efforts to remain active in the challenging and often depressive situation, the vast majority of camp residents are increasingly reliant on outside support and aid as a result of forced passivity. Due to the refugees in camps being forced to be nearly completely dependent on outside help for food, shelter, protection, and other basic needs, their coping mechanisms have been severely eroded. Travel and work restrictions within the camp as a result of the Thailand military coup of 2014 have had adverse psychological and social effects on the refugees, decreasing their self-sufficiency, camp morale, and mental health. As a young Karen refugee noted, living in the camp is similar to living in prison because I can't go outside or make my own decisions. I can commute only in the camp. The camp is surrounded by barbed wire. If we go outside the camp, Thai police will arrest us. In the long run, it affects not only my physical, but also my mental health. So we can talk a bit about the challenges, and there are many. In 2006, a study conducted by the PUAMI found that 50% of adult camp residents suffer from mental health problems, and antidepressants constituted one of the most common drug prescriptions for refugees. Additionally, domestic abuse is also cited as one of the social consequences of economic deprivation and frustration. WEAVE, which is a women's empowerment organization working in the camp, reports that domestic violence is pervasive in the camps and has exacerbated by the absence of work or to enable independence. Furthermore, halting long-term sustainability prospects in the camp has also created a climate where refugees tend to only think from short-term, from one ration to another, rather than long-term. And in the context of resettlement, many refugees will need assistance not only in skills to sustain themselves, but also in changing their thinking from short-term survival to long-term development. The seemingly intractable nature of Myanmar's ethnic conflicts has meant that for many years, resettlement to a third country has been the most appropriate, durable solution to the plight of many refugees. Since 2005, approximately 100,000 Myanmar refugees have resettled in the United States. We have a population close to 40,000 in between Dallas and Fort Worth alone. In addition to the U.S. departures, some 19,000 Myanmar refugees in Thailand have gone on to other resettlement countries, including Australia, Canada, Finland, and Japan. The United States has ended its group resettlement program for Myanmar refugees in January of 2014, citing a natural conclusion. Although individual refugees with specific protection needs would still be eligible on a case-by-case basis. For Burmese refugees who made this transition before the program ended, they will recount that the road to resettlement from the Thai refugee camp to the U.S. is both complicated and slow. Refugees often spend years in border camps, and only a small percentage of those will actually complete the resettlement process. This is a general overview of that process of coming from Burma to the U.S. You'll see you start by registering with as a refugee with the Thai Ministry of the Interior, and then there's a registration or verification of identity with UNHCR. I'll note that there are several refugees that never make it to this stage of actual registration, and for those refugees, they're more vulnerable than anybody in the camp. Without this registration, they don't have access to aid, and there's virtually no chance of being resettled legally into another country. If you make it to that resettlement phase, there will be an interview and pre-screening with the OPE, which is the Overseas Processing Entity. And then if you're very lucky, within about a year, you can maybe get an interview with the Department of Homeland Security for a final decision. In recent years, these interviews have become much more lengthy in process. I'll just add a brief bit about that. After September 11th, of course, this process dramatically changed. And we have situations where we'll have a family that is kind of in line for this background check. And if they have a child, then it puts them to the back because now their new baby needs to also have a security check. So the way that the US system has implemented this and the length of time creates several problems in this resettlement cycle. So after that decision, which if you're granted inclusion from the Department of Homeland Security, you'll have pre-department preparation by the IOM. And then, which is a medical screening, the cultural orientation, which I spoke about a little bit earlier, and then travel arrangements. And then there's departure to the U.S., usually via Bangkok, and then you will land in the U.S. or a resettlement agency will usually pick you up from the airport. And as a side note, which a lot of people don't know, refugees are actually expected to pay the U.S. government back for that travel to the U.S. So any plane ticket that the United States government is nice enough to give you, you will owe them. So there's several challenges in resettlement. As one refugee told me in a particularly heartbreaking interview, this was a 37-year-old Karen refugee that had been living in Dallas for 8 months. And she said, you know, life has been hard since coming to Dallas. I work two different shifts and I don't even see my daughter, but maybe 1 or 2 hours a day. These people broke into our apartment, they took everything, and the police, the apartment manager, they do nothing. There's no time to do anything, just work. There's nothing I can do. Really, I wish I could go back to the camp. Life was easier and happier there. So most refugees do rely on assistance from outside agencies when they first come to the U.S., known as VOLAGs, volunteer agencies as we call them. VOLAGs do receive a stipend from the U.S. government for each refugee they place and assist with areas such as housing, employment, language, and acculturation. The funding is limited, however, and a heavy emphasis is often placed on refugees to find employment and become self-sufficient as soon as possible. As government funding for resettlement programs has stalled over the past several years, determining how monetary assistance directly impacts the lives is more relevant for us. When there's not enough funding to sustain a prolonged assistance, how are we going to be able to maximize existing capital and create strategies that don't rely on monetary support? And often we are left frustrated and with a lot more questions than answers as we're trying to kind of navigate these different ethics and policy behind encouraging autonomy in the resettlement process. One of the most fundamental questions regarding effective resettlement, especially when funds are limited, is determining what should take precedence in the resettlement process. So most agencies in the U.S. have deemed rapid employment as the primary objective over ESL classes or any sort of formal acculturation. Volunteers are encouraged to help refugees find any employment available and accept the first job that's offered. This is not always ideal, as Dr. Nibbs talked about. They're often low pay and incommensurate with their work experience. And language acquisition is really the prerequisite to finding a job that has adequate pay. Depression can become a very serious problem with displaced people, as it can act to fuel this vicious cycle of helplessness and hopelessness. Older immigrants in particular are more at risk, as employment opportunities are often incongruent with their cumulative work experience and thus lead to lower socioeconomic status within their community. So what are the conclusions? What can we learn from all of this? Well, I think the good news is that agricultural initiatives, vocational training such as sewing, hairdressing, auto mechanics, these are all geared towards assisting refugees to earn their own livelihoods in a sustainable way and in a way that's going to be a living wage in the future. Refugee livelihoods are conceptualized, I hope so, in this presentation from a human rights-based approach, which recognizes that the denial of economic, social, and cultural rights by state government creates unnecessary suffering and dependency. Interviews with Karen refugees and NGO staff revealed that programs increase psychosocial well-being and the sense of empowerment for refugees. These things maintain skills and build new capacities for refugees to be self-sufficient in their future post-camp lives should they be resettled to the third country. It's up to us as academics and practitioners and those outside actors to listen to the refugees in our work and ensure that we are being effective in assisting the resettlement process and encouraging autonomy. Thank you.
Please join me to thank our presenters today.
Thank you.